All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Michael Krupit first joined CDNow as the Chief Technology Officer. He soon took over COO duties and eventually rose to become the CEO of the entire CDNow operation. In this episode, Mike gives us the background on the early days of yet another early e-commerce pioneer. And he gives us some great insights into the attempts that CDNow made to dominate a commerce niche as opposed to Amazon's everything store strategy. But just as fascinating is the fact that around the years 2000-2001, Michael was right there in the thick of it when the MP3 and Napster revolutions first rocked the music industry. This is a fascinating discussion about first being the disruptor and then eventually becoming the disrupted. Mike Krupit, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Great. Thanks very much for having me this afternoon.
I always like to start with a little bit dipping our toe into your education and your background. And I see that you attended Queens College, CUNY. Do you happen to be a New York City native by any chance?
I was born and raised mostly in the Bronx.
Oh, excellent. And you got your degree in computer science, and did you get 2 degrees?
Well, it was a joint major. It was the very early days of computer science. So I was an applied math major. Eventually, there was a computer science degree that I could dual major with it.
Mm-hmm. Looking at your LinkedIn for the companies that you were with after college, one that I wanted to ask you about was Knowledge Set, which you referred to as the granddaddy of CD-ROM companies. And I've said before on this podcast, a lot of people don't remember, but there was a bit of a CD-ROM bubble before the internet bubble. So you must have had a taste of that.
Well, yeah, we were part of pioneering it. I mean, these are the early days of personal computers when there were not CD drives built into them. Then Sony was beginning to put music onto CDs, and we had this concept that said, well, why not put data onto CDs? And we did a project for Grolier to put their encyclopedia on a CD, and we did a project for Federal Express, that was their name at the time, to put maintenance manuals on CD. And then, of course, you know, the user interface and all of the search systems had to be, a lot of that had to be integrated with the adapter hardware of the CD-ROM drives, because there was no standardizations of CDs on computers. So you had to be, a sort of a firmware engineer in order to be able to build a piece of software back in those days.
And you're basically a software engineer and a project manager at your first few positions, right?
Yeah, so I left college and I was a geek, and I loved building software, and for the first couple of companies I worked with, I built the stuff.
Yeah, you were at Verity, and then tell me what Infonautics was.
Infonautics was a fascinating company, co-founded by Marvin Weinberger and Josh Kopelman, and Josh subsequently went on to do Half.com and First Round Capital. But they had this concept of taking information and democratizing it for students. What they would describe at the time as the LexisNexis for kids. This is pre-commercialization of the internet. So everyone was getting online through AOL, CompuServe, and Prodigy. So the idea was, let's package a service work with publishers, package all of their content into a service, allow really friendly searching over that content, and put it into these online services for kids to access. Along the way, the internet happened, right? It became commercially viable. And before we went public, we had to move the whole thing onto the internet. And it became the Electric Library. And that lasted for a few years until people realized you couldn't make money off of content on the internet, especially back in those early days in the mid-90s.
Initially, though, you were making content deals with the AOLs and the CompuServes of the world.
They were the portal, for lack of a better word, right? They were the provider. They brought us the customers and the connectivity and the subscribers, right? So the subscription dollars. Mm-hmm. We brought the publishers. So we went after 400 different publishers and asked them to digitize or provide us with their already digitized information. And we would put it into one single database.
So you're an aggregator that creates channels, I guess, for lack of a better word, on these.
Exactly.
And so the move to the web was not very successful at all?
Well, the move to the web was very successful. The business model wasn't.
Right.
Because all of a sudden now people stop paying for online services. What happened to AOL and Prodigy and CompuServe and dial-up? It went away. People stopped paying those subscriptions, and we had to make our money off of charging subscriptions on wide web back in those days. And you couldn't get people to pay for content.
So tell me about how you come to CD Now. Were you recruited, or did you seek them out? How did that happen?
If I remember correctly, I was recruited. I had decided to part ways with Infonautics for a handful of reasons, and I was looking at what was next, and I wanted to stay in the Philadelphia region. And there was a whole bunch. It was the beginning of what we would look back on and call the bubble, right? So or the boom, I guess, depending upon which side of it you're looking.
Right, glasses half full or half empty. Yeah, right.
So in this side, it was the boom side, right? It was the very beginning of the boom, and there was a lot of good companies forming in Philadelphia. VerticalNet was one of them. And CD Now reached out to me through a recruiter. They, founded by twin brothers, Matt and Jason Olam, they were ready to take their company to the level and bring on really experienced software engineering. They didn't have a real professional software group at the time. They had a few engineers and a few hackers, and Matt and Jason wrote a little bit of code, but for the most part, nobody there had background in professional experience in software development. So they sought me out as CTO.
So you come on as the chief technology officer.
Correct. The company was about 2.5 years old at the time and had about 40 employees.
Well, so because you're the first person from CD Now that we've spoken to, I know you weren't there for it, but if you could just give us sort of, the Cliff Notes version of, the founding story. It's two brothers that are right out of college. And from what I read in the book that that Jason wrote about mm-hmm. the founding, essentially the idea was that he sort of had the idea that you could have a better music store, and it kind of was that simple, the idea and the founding.
Yeah, well, he was looking for a particular piece of music. He had been out of school for about a year, had been working, was looking for a particular piece of music, Miles Davis, and couldn't find it, right? You'd go to a what we call them at those days, record stores, right? You'd go to a record store, and you were limited to whatever stock they had on hand. So there could be 200,000 music SKUs out there in catalogs, but they would only have 10,000 on the shelf of a music store. And he was a little frustrated, wanted to know why he couldn't buy it through some other means, and saw the internet as a way to potentially offer people to buy their music, not to acquire it, right? Because we're not delivering music online at the time. But like Amazon starting to sell books over the internet, why can't we just sell CDs? And the challenge that you didn't want to keep physical inventory, right? Amazon certainly did it, and it took a lot of time and money to build out that infrastructure. So Jason had a different approach. He went to the record distributors who were distributing to record stores. So, you know, in your music industry, you've got the people creating the music, the people publishing the music, the people distributing the music, and then of course the people buying the music. And so there were distributors who would get the music from the labels and sell them to retailers. And he approached one of them and says, well, look, instead of, you know, shipping Tower Records or Barnes & Noble a case, you know, could you just ship a couple to individual people? Could you do drop shipping? And I believe it was Valley Records who said, yeah, we'll give that a shot. There's this whole new era of e-commerce that we're willing to be part of. So they adapted their systems to drop ship direct and that made CD Now possible. So Jason built a store. I believe the first version was on a telnet, which was it's, you know, pre-commercialization of the web. It's right. Really about a character-based interface. And then when the web became commercialized, he at that point, built a web server and moved the whole system online as well onto the web. But it was really just a frustration that there was more music to be had than you could get it at brick and mortar.
Yeah, it's interesting because Amazon essentially has the same business model initially, just to be a middleman, just to be the person that instead of going to the record store and making a special order or going to the bookstore and making a special order, well, just put the catalogs online, and being a middleman, you take a cut for providing the service. But like, it's not e-commerce as we would think of it today, because you don't want the inventory. You're just being the middleman.
Correct. And that's our entire operation.
They never ever had warehouses or anything?
Except for some swag, marketing swag, or, you know, frequent buyer bonuses. No, we never took inventory. Mm-hmm.
So again, reading his book, Jason's book, it reminded me of the first company I started, in terms of, like, you know, you remember the first week that you make $1,000 or whatever, but it seems like they, unlike other companies, especially in the dot-com madness era, they didn't get big fast. They didn't run out and get a whole bunch of venture capital. They literally, for like the first two and a half years, were just growing based on the revenue that they were bringing in. Is that right?
That's correct.
Was there hesitancy to get VC money? Was it about being on the East Coast, maybe?
You know, so I wish I could speak to that. I can't. I wasn't there. But my, you know, by just recollection and observation, I think it was just a lack of a desire to do so. Yes, in the East Coast at that time, you know, venture capital and angel investing was not as easy as it was on the West Coast, where I had recently moved from. But I don't think it was the challenge. I think it was more the desire, right? If you've got a business that organically is doubling every 6 months, why not do it ourselves, right? And I don't think anybody had a vision when we started this, you know, that we'd be doing $150 million in music, as we ended up doing. I think it was, let's just sell music. This is fun, and we're making money.
When you're brought in, what is the stage of the company at this point? It's maybe 2.5 years old, 2 years old.
It's probably 2.5 to 3 years old. It's 40 employees. It's about $300,000 in revenue. I believe there was an angel investor in at that time, maybe a couple, but mm-hmm. but I remember one specifically.
So when you show up, what are the problems you're facing? What are you brought on to do? What are your first tasks that you need to tackle?
well, given the fact that the company had been doubling every 6 months, the stakes were growing geometrically, and and ultimately exponentially. But yet the technology wasn't advancing at that same rate.
Because they had basically been hacking it together themselves this whole time.
You got it. Mm-hmm. Our developers weren't necessarily all professional or experienced developers. We had no systems and processes, assurance, and no product management. The servers lived. We were located in an old post office at a train station on the suburban regional rail in Philadelphia, in suburban Philly, and there was no air conditioning upstairs. The servers were in a closet under the stairs, under the stairwell.
Melting, apparently.
Yes. And we couldn't, the developers were all in one room, all six of us. And we couldn't use the window air conditioner unit on because it would make the power go out and the system would go down. So needless to say, it was just like, all right, we got to fix this. So I remember my first couple weeks at the company, I got a folding table and I put it next to Matt's desk. Matt's the brother who had been running technology. So in the middle of the day, the system goes down. I don't recall why, but Matt's like working on other things. And I tap Matt on the shoulder. Are you going to look at this?
The site is down to users, you mean?
The site is down to users, right. And Matt's working on something else. He says, well, let me finish what I'm working on. We'll get to it a little later. So that's a little bit of the culture that I was trying to change at the time. It was just like, all right, well, look, we've got a business that's completely dependent upon our technology, and we don't necessarily have an appreciation for making that technology the center of what it is that we're doing. Yes, we're a marketing company. We're selling music. That's ultimately how we get our revenues. But this is the early days of the internet. We couldn't use anyone else's technologies. We had to invent it, and it had to be good. Mm-hmm. If the site's down, nobody's buying music. It doesn't matter how good our brand is. I remember we were going to talk to investors, and I was in the car with Jason one day, and I said, Jason, what's the one thing you want me to do? And so, of course, he rattled, like any good CEO, he rattled off 10 things. Jason, put them in order. And eventually I got him to give me one thing. And that was, you know, I want 100% availability during the holiday shopping season. I says, you got it. Now, my first challenge was, you know, I needed professional engineers. My second challenge was I needed to put processes in place. My third challenge was I needed to figure out the right role for Matt, who was responsible for technology, but didn't want to lead it, but still was very intimately involved in it.
And was a co-founder.
I was a co-founder. And that was, you know, look, the values, the core values that Jason and Matt had were very well-grounded people. They had very strong and positive values. So we had a lot of authenticity in the room. And so there was never really a conflict of, I joke sometimes that I felt like the third twin, because I would talk to Jason and then I would talk to Matt, and I'd relay what Matt and Jason are saying to one another, to each other. So it was very family-like CDNow back in those days. And so the fact was that it didn't matter that, you know, the founder was in a sense reporting to me. So I set a goal. I said, all right, look, we're going to have 100% availability for the holiday season. And oh, by the way, Matt's going to take a vacation because he hasn't been out of the office in 3 years. Matt slept in the office. He sometimes went home to his parents' house and showered and came back to the office. I don't even think when I joined the company, Matt had his own place to live. And that, you know, you can't keep doubling every 6 months unless you break out of that startup culture. So that was my goal, right? 100% availability, real software, and Matt, in a sense, becomes dispensable. Matt can get on the road and take a vacation.
And you were able to achieve that.
We did it.
Yep.
We did it. So that was the holiday shopping season of 1997. Mm-hmm. Matt took 2 weeks off. He actually challenged me even more than I was intending to be challenged. I believe he took 2 weeks off, and took a car on a road trip without his phone. So talk about no safety net. Right. Our system was up 100%.
Amazon
was down during that holiday season. Yahoo was down during that holiday season.
I was going to say that would have been the busiest time of year for you, clearly.
It was. It was a busy time for anyone, e-commerce or all the online portals. They were down. We were up. We did an amazing job. We built a team. We had the right technology. We met all the business's goals. And because of that, we were able to not only take the company public, but to start doing nationwide advertising.
Well, let's back up for just one second.
Yeah.
Because at this point, and even going back to when you join, who are your competitors? Or not only who are your competitors, but who do you feel like are your competitors? Is it other online players like Music Boulevard or CD Connection? Or are you already gunning for like the Tower Records and people like that?
All the above. So first and foremost, it's our online competitors, Music Boulevard and CD Universe, I believe at the time were the two that we look over our shoulders back towards. We were bigger than both of them. And then it was online. We online was being challenged by us. You know, we're offline. I'm sorry, brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. What was Blockbuster and Tower Records and all these companies going to go online and start doing what they do? Or were we just going to eat their business?
You know, that's interesting. As I'm researching all of these cases, I can't find an instance where offline was able to beat back online. You know, going all the way through to Blockbuster and Netflix and things like that. It's not to say that online destroys offline all the time, but. there's not a case that I've been able to find yet where a brick and mortar company beat down and defeated the online upstarts, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's because, you know, the brick and mortar companies have, an infrastructure that doesn't move as gracefully as a young online company. So, you know, just logically growing an online company is so much, less risky than growing brick and mortar. And once you've got big brick and mortar, moving difficult. So they were at a huge disadvantage, in part because of their size and in part because of their lack of mastery of the technology.
Before we get to the IPO and things like that, I wanted to just tick off some of the things that I feel like CDNOW was an innovator in terms of things that it brought to e-commerce, to creating the idea of e-commerce as we understand it now. And one of the things is, this seems completely no-brainer obvious today, but providing sound samples of songs and things like that to sample before you purchase. But that was actually really, really hard to do at the time technologically, just for bandwidth purposes, for technical purposes, all sorts of stuff.
It was for legal purposes, right? We were breaking new ground in many directions. So technologically, right? I mean, we didn't have the bandwidth. That became a big issue. Music Boulevard, for example, solved it by they ripped and edited all their own sound samples. We ended up partnering with other companies to do it. So Music Boulevard had to have a big pipe and big servers and stream a lot of music, and we did it more distributed through third parties. But yeah, that was pioneering grounds to be able to allow people to listen to that music and the technology to deliver those bits of music, and then the format. I mean, just think about, you know, back in those days, what format do we distribute that music in? Windows Media, Real Audio, there's MP3. There was all these competing and conflicting ways of people listening to their music. And in fact, I remember Microsoft paying us a lot of money to start adopting their, Windows Media File.
Mm-hmm. This is just my own possibly faulty recollection, but I always remember it being mostly Real Audio. Was that the biggest format at the time?
For us, we did a lot of Real Audio because we worked with a provider who had that. Although we were, you know, we did start to do Windows Media for a fair amount.
Another thing to mention is things like you know, the, like the My CD Now page, the wish list, like introducing personalization, because, you know, music is a very personal taste driven thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. So we were pioneers in that. My CD Now was a huge undertaking for us because nobody else on the internet was doing it. In fact, Amazon had tried and backed off. They failed. We did some of it on our own. We worked with partners like NetPerceptions, who had a collaborative filtering engine, to really offer people the ability to see the homepage and recommendations and emails that were custom tailored to them, and unintrusively, right, based on their buying habits and behaviors, as opposed to them filling out forms of what they like and what they don't. And so we pioneered that. I mean, we were really the first major online retailer e-commerce system to really do that. That's that level of personalization.
And what about things like ratings and recommendations of if you like this, you like that?
Exactly. So those were all data points that went into the collaborative filtering engine that made custom recommendations for you.
Another thing to tick is being very, very early on the affiliate program, which might have predated you, but if you have any recollections on that.
I wasn't there for the early days of it, but I was there while we were still the first. We pioneered affiliate. Cosmic Credit was another big undertaking that we took, and we did it in a way that put music people in charge of it, right? And that was something that I think made CD Now different, was that we didn't, our customer service agents, many of our developers, certainly all our business people were music people. They got the industry. They loved music. And so you know, the opportunity to work for CD Now was a dream come true for many of them, where they can bring their professional careers and their personal passions together. So that's partly why the affiliate program works so well, is because we were music fans reaching out to other music fans to promote the sale of our music.
So that kind of brings us up back to the Christmas of 97, which I feel like was one of the first big Christmases for e-commerce. But it was also big for you guys because when the IPO is after Christmas of 97 or before?
No, it was after.
After, right. But it's around this time that I think you did get some more VC money in. And so you're starting to market in a very big way. Like you start to sponsor the American Music Awards and the Grammy Awards and things like that.
Yeah. So we did what was called a mezzanine round because we wanted to go public. So we wanted to go public with cash in the bank. So we did the mezzanine round and we started spending it. All right. So first and foremost, we spent it in the online portals, right? Back then, you know, remember AOL, Yahoo. I'm trying to think of who else was there at the time.
AltaVista, Lycos. Yeah. Right.
Everybody wanted exclusivity. So this is before, right, you know, performance-based advertising. So to get in bed with Yahoo or AOL, we'd have to do a $3 million deal or some deals as big as $8 million. In parallel with all of that, we wanted to build our credibility, our brand in the music industry. So we had to do deals with Rolling Stone and MTV. And a little extension of that was, well, like, let's start advertising and marketing like a real music retailer. And that's when we decided to do offline advertising. Offline advertising on television and focused on the American Music Awards and the Grammys.
Well, and just to underline that though, wasn't like the deal with MTV like a $20 million deal or something? Like it was over several years, but I mean these are enormous deals.
These are enormous deals, which is why, you know, the cash went quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there are some performance-based attributes of these deals, but for the most part, you know, you are writing $3 million checks. And that got you placement as to, you know, to be the, you know, to be the place where that portal can sell your music, whether it's MTV or Yahoo. And there was no other way of doing it online back then.
And the question I want to ask is how effective was it? One of the things is that I feel like the dot-com bubble burst because people eventually woke up and realized that the online advertising wasn't converting. I'm not asking you for specific numbers or percentages or things like that, but did you guys get the sense that all of a sudden you're throwing these millions of dollars out there and is it working for you?
So we were one of the other things we pioneered were metrics, and we were extraordinarily driven by numbers, which is sort of what everyone does today, but back then nobody had, offline retailers didn't have access to the data that we had access to. So we were very much driven by the numbers. We knew that none of these deals were paying off, right? That it was cost, music is a low margin product. We knew the lifetime value of our customer, knew what it was costing us to acquire a customer in every given channel. And we knew that we were losing money in many of those channels. The most effective and efficient platform was affiliates, right? 30% of our revenues came from affiliates, and they were our most profitable customers.
Wow, 30%.
But the 50% that came unbranded, that just typed in cdnow.com and came to us without any attribution, that we had to say, all right, look, we're doing these deals with AOL and MTV and Rolling Stone and Yahoo, so they must be paying off in terms of brand, right? Because we couldn't justify it with the CPA of just an acquisition of a single customer. A few years later, when we decided to sell the Bertelsmann, we used that as an opportunity to get out a lot of these deals because these deals just weren't worth it. I mean, we in the couple of years we had these deals, we knew that it wasn't a way that we'd grow the business.
Again, To frame it in terms of the competitors, you guys are successful in terms of basically being the king of the online pack against the Music Boulevards and people like that. But like at what point are you feeling like you're really competing and you're a real threat to the Virgins and the Tower Records and people like that?
I think there was a point when we realized that 1% of the music sold in the United States is sold through CD Now. And that was sort of a recognition that, we're a real contender. I mean, we are bigger than many of the record stores out there. Now, the music industry, and this was a challenge that we had that was unlike what Amazon had with books, was and maybe still is extraordinarily corrupt. And so there were things, because we didn't keep inventory, there were things that we couldn't do for the labels or the music distributors that a brick and mortar player could do. And that was a struggle with us till the very end. So for example, a music label will reach out to Target and say, can you take $1 million extra of product for this holiday season? Don't worry, you can return it in February. So they could make their numbers look good for that year. We couldn't do that, right? We couldn't offer them all sorts of deals. So, in exchange, do us this favor, you'll get an exclusive Britney Spears extended version. So there were things that hindered our ability to sort of be the to work to rise to the top of the music industry. But we knew, based on our volumes and based on our brand and based on how much attention was being paid to what it is that we were doing, that it was the start of a change in the industry that you couldn't back out of.
Let's talk about then Amazon as a competitor. I'm sorry, this is a flaw in my research here. I don't actually know when Amazon introduces music. It's probably, what, 98?
Yeah, I can't recall exactly. It was sort of midstream of my tenure with CD Now. It might have been a little bit later than that. And Amazon reaches out to us early on and says, look, will you do our music for you, for us? That sort of makes a lot of sense. We couldn't come to terms. They decide to do music on their own. By this point, we've merged with Music Boulevard, mm-hmm. and gone public. So, we kind of looked at Amazon getting into the music space. While it is threatening because Amazon was somewhat of a dominant player, although, certainly nothing like what they are today. we knew that we were the music brand, right? Amazon was a book brand. We were the music brand. We had a building, 90,000 square feet full of people who knew everything there was to know about music. We would often run tests between our music, our customer service and Amazon's customer service. Our customers would send us a line from a song and we would immediately know what song that was and what album that was and send them a link to go buy it. You ask Amazon's customer service about a line in a song, you know, you don't get an answer. So we felt that, you know, we weren't going to be the low price player, but we were going to be the music brand and the music service company. Right. So people would pay for our knowledge and the experience of working with CDNow.
You know what? Maybe put a pin in that thought because I want to come back to that. But
yeah.
Was there a realization that, so obviously you guys are taking we're going to specialize in our niche. And so, okay, Amazon maybe gets better press, maybe gets better love from Wall Street or whatever. But if we concentrate in our niche, we'll be fine. Is there a point where you realize, no, these guys are going to do everything and they don't care about niches. They want to do it all.
I think so, but I think it was by the time we realized that it was almost too late. That was probably more on the decline end of CDNow as opposed to the upswing of us. So I don't think that was something that we were concerned about during my tenure with the company.
So again, put a pin in that and we'll come back to it. But so eventually you personally, you're the COO and then eventually the CEO. Can you just give me the timeline of that, how that evolves?
Yeah. So the CTO job, look, once you have 100% availability and a team in place, what does the CTO do, right? So there was so much more I could do for the business. I took over ultimately. It took accountability for customer service and product management, and then eventually distribution and fulfillment, because it's all about people and process, right? The leadership skills that you develop in running a technology organization are transferable to really a lot of the other disciplines. So I moved very seamlessly from CTO to COO. I didn't become CEO until we decided to sell to Bertelsmann and it was clear that Jason was going to step up. There was, and we might be jumping ahead a little bit in the history, right?
There
was a period of time where there was a number of deals that had fallen through. There was the market was about to crash. There wasn't going to be capital for us. And we saw that we had to sell the company. It was during that transition that they looked more to me as to become the CEO as opposed to, prior to that, while Jason was still with the company.
Okay. Well, yeah, let's do get into that. So,
yeah,
99 is the height of the full on mania. By 2000, for the larger context of the bubble, that's when things start to turn. But also, it's interesting that at this exact time, when it comes to specifically music, things are starting to change because it's 99-2000 that the MP3 revolution starts to happen.
Yeah.
And I'd love to know how that evolved for you guys, seeing MP3s become a thing.
Well, so MP3s MP3s we thought were the future of the music industry. Like we were not naive to think that shipping out physical CDs was where the industry was going to be long term.
Were there plans in place to move in that direction, move to becoming
We were. Acquiring the licenses was very difficult, right? We worked with a whole bunch of third parties to be able to do it, people who were aggregating online content. Problem was that the music labels at the time weren't giving you the content that people wanted to buy in digital format. And that didn't happen until Amazon and until Apple and the iPod and iTunes, right? So we were 10 years before that trying to do digital music and it was just way too early. The industry wasn't there, the music industry, the technology wasn't there, the bandwidth wasn't there. I still have my first MP3 player. It was one of the RCA Lyras that I got while I was at CDNow. I don't use it, of course, but because it takes those compact hard drives, right? Those compact drives.
Well, and you could get maybe one CD on there Yeah.
And the technology to transfer music to your CD players, your MP3 players was terrible. So we sold music, we served digital music, but we didn't sell anything that anybody wanted. And that was sort of,
So you're saying you couldn't get the Spice Girls and Britney Spears because you couldn't get those licenses.
That's correct. Nobody, yeah. It was a bad time to be transforming the music industry. What had happened was the music industry had spent the last decade converting everyone from records and cassettes to CDs. So they made billions of dollars off of not creating new music, but off of just reselling existing music.
Back catalog stuff.
Right. And then what happened was the salad days are over all of a sudden. It's like, everyone's already replaced their collections. We're having trouble selling CDs because, frankly, there's no new music. There's no good music. only so many people want to buy Britney Spears and NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys. And every genre of music was declining except for, I believe, hip hop at the time was the only growing segment of music. So the fact is the music industry was all of a sudden, after hundreds of millions of dollars in profits, are now facing losses. And so they're clamping down, right? They're getting more protective, not more open. They're worried now that people are going to steal music. And so they really held on to their old ways because they couldn't figure out what to do next. And it's very different from the TV industry or the movie industry or the book industry, which has always embraced new technologies, sometimes kicking and screaming, but the music industry has never done that.
Well, and also, sorry to interrupt, but you earlier said, I believe you said that the music industry was corrupt. And listen, this is almost famous now how hard even Steve Jobs, who had the reality distortion field, had to work to pull them kicking and screaming. But was there something unique about the culture? Is there something unique about the culture of the recording industry that made it sort of just, I don't know, a bitch to deal with or something?
I just think it's the, I don't know that it's unique, and I can't look to other industries and compare them. It's difficult to look at them apples to apples. But the fact is that the way people make money in music was a way that sort of made a small number of people extremely wealthy and consolidated power, and that's a really hard model to break.
Well, it's a hard model to get the people that are making the money to break.
Correct, and they're the people who have the power, though.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So let's do get to the what you called the sort of the downswing of CD now. So there are several in 98, 99, 2000, there are several abortive attempts to merge with people, to get bought out by people. I mean, even like Columbia House and things like that. What's going on when we're reaching the bubble bursting?
So there's a few things that happened. First, we merged with Music Boulevard, right? The idea was that, look, they're nipping at our heels, in part because they're doing things that we didn't think were good for the industry, like discounting, couponing, a product that already was low margin. I mean, how do you give free shipping and $5 off a product that you can't, that only has $2 of profit? So our strategy was, well, we'll buy them and we'll integrate them with us, and one and one is equal to three. Of course, one and one ultimately amounted to 1.5, and really, really distracted us in a bad way. And if I had 20/20 hindsight, I could say bad mistake. We should have just let them work themselves into oblivion by making those sort of mistakes, instead of taking those mistakes on and fixing them ourselves. So we have we did that after we realized that the market continues to be competitive, margins continue to be compressed, and we had been spending too much money. We needed more money, right? But that more money wasn't readily available to us as the market's starting to get uncomfortable. We also see the vision that what all of these big music brands offline have to get online. So why don't we start to embrace them and maybe merge with an offline company? And that's when we decided to get together with Columbia House. Columbia House was the biggest music club, right? So they would ship music by mail, typically not front catalog, mostly back catalog stuff. And they were, they were a fairly, multi-hundred-million-dollar operation, and we thought bringing them together with us as the best of both worlds. They had close relationships with the industry. They had a brand. They had customers. We had the technology and the e-commerce piece, and they needed what we had, and we wanted what they had. So we looked to do a merger of equals. Columbia House was owned by Sony and Time Warner. They were jointly owned. So we decided to merge it, and CDNOW would become sort of the online operations for the combined entity. And we started working towards building that. Well, along the way, what happens is that through our due diligence, we realized that Columbia House is losing far more money than anyone ever thought they were, which is a shock to Sony and Time Warner because they weren't paying attention. Sony is already having a bad year, so they're a little bit uncomfortable about letting us about doing this deal, because then they have even more losses that they have to recognize. Time Warner all of a sudden is now in discussions with AOL to get acquired. So 9 months into this deal, they decide to cancel it. And at that point, we're on our own.
How does it end up with Bertelsmann?
So the story gets even more interesting. So we said, all right, look, we either have to sell the company or go chapter 11. There's no secondary market for money anymore, and we're at this point still losing probably about $65 million a year. So the company was kept afloat based upon the fact that we had, we had 3-day terms with our credit card providers and 90-day terms with our music vendors. So we were living off the float of $150 million of e-commerce.
It's a beautiful thing.
It was. I wonder that we should have just applied for a banking license. So I start the Chapter 11. At this point, I'm COO, and Jason sort of backs off a little bit, trying to figure out what's next. And this is pretty emotional, for Jason and Matt as they're seeing their baby, sort of in this precarious position. And so I did a lot of work with Jason, but with our general counsel, to sort of proceed down the two paths, either to get the company sold or to take a Chapter 11. And we hired an investment banker. We put the company up for sale. We kissed a whole bunch of frogs. Ultimately, we thought there was 5 companies that were interested in putting in a bid, and there was the day that all the bids were due, and none of those companies, we got no bid submitted. So here we are thinking, all right, well, now we've got to pull the trigger on Chapter 11. And then not too long after that, and this is more on Jason's end, I don't recall the dates, magic happened. So because of the AOL Time Warner merger, AOL has to divest their European operations. Well, because their AOL Europe was jointly owned between Bertelsmann and AOL. So right, AOL right. was forced to buy Bertelsmann for what I believe was $7 billion in cash. So Bertelsmann all of a sudden is sitting on $7 billion in cash. So they decide to create the Bertelsmann e-commerce group, and they take the guy who was the COO of AOL Europe, Andreas Schmidt, and put him in charge of the Bertelsmann e-commerce group. They give him $1 billion. They say, go make us direct to consumer.
Go shopping.
Yep. And so we were his first purchase. It was a lifesaver for us. We would have been Chapter 11 otherwise.
I want to come back to something else, but how does it end up with Amazon in the end?
As the company like progresses or at the very, very end?
Yeah, the very, very end. The brand gets kicked around back and forth. In this post-Napster era, I'm sure it's chaotic. Let me take that back. Because you stay on after the sale, right?
Yeah. So I stay on. They make me CEO. I spend half of my time in New York working with Bertelsmann, half of my time in Philly. They hate Philadelphia. Philadelphia doesn't have good talent. Philadelphia doesn't have experience in direct marketing. We can do it a lot better up here in New York. So they hire Booz Allen to go do a study, and the study is already the answer is predetermined. They want to close Philadelphia down. We do that dance for about a year and a half before they finally say, look, we're folding your operations into our New York department, who mostly was running a music club, the BMG Music Service. Mm-hmm. And we'll bring a few people up with us, but for the most part, we're shutting down Philadelphia. And at that point, so I spent a couple years, sort of trying to make CD Now better. And in fact, we were. We did turn the company around. So when I took over the company, we were about 150 million, you're losing 65 million. A year later, our losses were down to 25 million. So we had a $40 million improvement on the bottom line. So we really did have a plan to turn, to make it, profitable and ultimately scalable to the point where all the offline stuff could easily be accommodated by online.
The plan is you are actively transitioning to online sales, to digital sales, I should say.
That was part of the plan. So, in fact, one of the things that I was asked to do, Bertelsmann had also given Napster a loan. They'll call it an investment. Napster guys will call it a loan. So they put us together with Napster, and they say, CD Now, you make money off of selling music online. Napster, you don't, but you've got a brand and a lot of people. CD Now, give Napster some revenue. So they lock me in a room with Hank Barry and Sean Fanning and say, all right, well, go figure it out. And ultimately we did. We did incorporate a buy it now button on the Napster client, and Napster did generate revenues from selling music legally. But the whole thing with Bertelsmann didn't last long. A year and a half into it, they decide to close it. After they shut CD Now down, what they decide to do was just operate the brand. So they become, in a sense, an affiliate of Amazon, right? They become they let Amazon use the CD Now brand. They send all the traffic to Amazon, and Bertelsmann gets a cut. So it's a super affiliate hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. It's just it's casting the brand to sea, basically. So.
Yes.
I want to come back to a couple things. Number one, I have not gotten in our narrative yet to the point of Napster, and so I have not done the research, but obviously you're an excellent person to talk about this era, because you're dealing with record companies and you're coming, it's right after the dot-com bust, but it's in the midst of Napster blowing up the record industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was that like? Like, what was there a sense of just people running around with their hair on fire, like not like it's all crashing down our entire business model? Like, just speak a little bit to what that environment was like working with the record companies at that point.
Yeah, you know what? It was a little bit. It wasn't like that. At least my recollection is it wasn't like that. And mind you, I only spent 5 years in the music industry, you know, with CD Now, and I never went back and I never looked back. But my observation was that there was a lot of legal maneuverings behind the scenes and ultimately, you know, in the courts. But there wasn't a lot of panic because nobody thought it was sustainable, right? It was an awareness that a tide was turning. There was a little bit of a panic because they didn't know what they were going to do about it. But there was also this feeling that, you know, we're bigger, we're scarier, we have resources, we have money, their stuff won't last.
Are they confident? Well, they're confident it's a fad almost?
I would say that they were.
Napster itself specifically or digital downloads in general?
Napster itself, the peer-to-peer sharing, mm-hmm. right? They thought they could fix that in the courts. And, you know, look, I think ultimately they did.
Right.
But the digital part, they were beginning to see that was where they had to go. They just didn't know how to get there. And it wasn't until Steve Jobs made them go there that they figured it out.
And your dealings with Napster and Sean Fanning and those guys, do you feel like there was ever a chance that could have been a real company, or your impressions of them?
My interactions with them were somewhat limited. So they were guarded in the conversations they had with us because they viewed Bertelsmann as a debtor, not as an investor. So they were being courteous to Bertelsmann. I don't think they were as in bed with them as Bertelsmann would have liked to think. So I only got to see a very skewed perspective, but one would think because Hank Barry had gotten involved that they were looking to legitimize the business, but I didn't see any evidence of that happening.
And then let's come back to the thing that I wanted you to put the pin in. And so this comes back to the e-commerce roots of CD Now. And we've sort of touched on, the idea that, you know, looking back on it now, you would think of this history of, well, it's obvious. Amazon is e-commerce. It does everything. It's the steamroll that steamrolls everything. But I remember at the time being actually a pretty loyal CD Now customer. And even now in retrospect, like, I don't think it's that obvious. Why couldn't there be more stronger niches in e-commerce? And I'm not asking you to have an answer for that, but do you feel in retrospect that there were things that CD Now could have done to hide in its niche, to protect its niche and to have thrived there?
I think we did all we could do. Between our stellar customer service, raising content and all of our you know relationships with the big names in music, it was everything that we could do. I think the challenge was that we were in a market where margins were low. Often retailers, the big box retailers especially, would use music as a loss leader to get people in the doors. A niche that requires, you know, a niche for a commodity product, right? It doesn't matter where you buy the music,
right?
A commodity low margin product, I just don't think makes a successful niche business, right? Most of the successful niche markets have been in, you know, higher margin differentiable products.
Right,
eyewear and clothes and things like that. I don't think, you know, because music is a commodity, I don't think it ever had the chance to be differentiated, you know, kind of like music, kind of like in a way.
That never occurred to me, but you're right. At the time, and it's to some extent still today, but more at that time, DVDs and CDs were loss leaders. That was the business model of Walmart and Best Buy to get you in the store. And then, that never occurred to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, how do you compete with that? Right. You can't, you know, I've got a market to get people in my door. I've got to you know, pay to ship product to people, and I've got a whole bunch of technology to support. And back then the technology was not cheap. I mean, it's not like it is today. So, you know, if people are taking what I'm doing and using it as a loss leader, I don't see a sustainable business there.
Well, let's end by, you said that you were in, the music business, quote unquote, for, 4 or 5 years, but you haven't looked back. You've gone on to do a bunch of other stuff, with all sorts of varied, tech companies. Right now I believe you're with, Intranet and Trajectify. Those are the two projects you're working on. Tell us about those.
Sure. When I left my seventh startup, Real Foodworks, which was my first startup in the food space, but I said no more. I'm done with startups. I went around to investors and entrepreneurs and service providers to try to find holes in the market, and a lot of people were complaining about mentoring. And after I peeled the layers, I found that it was really about coaching. And so I started a coaching practice for entrepreneurs, and within 5 weeks had 5 clients, and it was the offering I was putting together, the services I was packaging for these entrepreneurs were sort of a good product market fit. So I've been spending the last year and a half now honing that coaching practice, doing peer groups and private coaching, and organizing events in a way that gives a more contemporary view to coaching entrepreneurs from both a leadership perspective, you know, growing their performance and pushing them out of their comfort zone to use that to affect growth of their business. And so that, and predominantly, you know, entrepreneurs who are in the growth stages, right, who have a quarter, $500,000 revenue or more, and are wondering, you know, what do I need to become? What does the company need to become for me to double that? So that's where I spend most of my time. But along the way, I meet a co-founder, Martin Babinick, who happens to be the founder of Trinet. He's got this idea for a tech startup, and I think at that point I realized that being a tech entrepreneur is an addiction. I couldn't say no. I had to find a way to make it work. I really wanted to work on the product, and I really wanted to work with Martin. So we formed Intranet, which is a system that initially has been built to facilitate introductions. But longer term, it's really about relationship capital, about being able to measure and visualize and increase relationship capital. And we've been working on that for about a year and have learned a lot and are in the process of putting together the roadmap for the next few years based on what we've learned.
That's, you know what, I just put together that the way that you and I put together this interview was through Trajectify, through your one of your companies, which actually, by the way, it was actually really cool. So I recommend people checking that out.
Yeah, thanks.
Mike, I want to thank you for taking the time to remember all this for us. I think I mentioned I loved CNE Now back in the day, so I was really eager to do some sort of a profile on them, and also I really identified with their founding story personally. But unlike, you know, I've interviewed almost all of the key people for the various search engines and web browsers and things like that, but I don't want the story of e-commerce to just be, well, Amazon came and is Amazon was, and that's it, because there was a lot of other pioneers. So I'm glad that you were able to share some of those pioneering e-commerce stories with CD Now.
Well, thanks very much, Brian, for giving me the opportunity to do that.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.